Hi everyone, and welcome to the Planorama podcast, brought to you by Toronto Metropolitan University's School of Urban and Regional Planning Alumni Association. You heard that right. Ryerson University is now Toronto Metropolitan University, and the RPAA is now CERPA. But Planorama is still Planorama, and I, Neil Lowen, could not be more excited to be hosting my very first episode today. If this is your first episode, Planorama is a fun little alumni engagement podcast where each episode features a chat with a different TMU planning grad from over the years. But before we dive in, I wanted to introduce myself to you in case we haven't met yet. I'm Neil Lowen. I graduated from CERP with a master's in planning in 2016, and I'm a senior associate urban planner at Urban Strategies in Toronto. I've been on CERPA for 7 years now, playing a variety of roles, from communications coordinator to secretary to co-chair, and now finally at the helm of the Planorama podcast, trying to step into the big shoes of the previous hosts, Ashley Patton and Ray Lister, excited to get to chat with the many incredible planning alumni from TMU and talk about city building and maybe the world more broadly. Let's meet today's guest, a true gem of the CERP alumni community, a tireless volunteer for the association over many, many years, convener of many bike tours and professional development workshops, planner at Kagan Shastri DeMello Weiner Park LLP, transit enthusiast and all-around good guy, Chris Drew. Welcome, Chris Drew, land use planner at Kagan Shastri DeMello Weiner Park LLP.
You named them all, so you win the prize.
Yes. And a Burple graduate from TMU CERP in the year 2000, say it with me.
Nine?
I didn't need you to say it with me. But also the longest serving active member of the School of Urban and Regional Planning Alumni Association, part of the Gold Wristwatch Club. We don't have one of those. We use our money very wisely.
I opted for the gold bike helmet.
Yeah, perfect. And over the years, you have led many student and alumni engagement activities, including bike tours, walk tours, professional development activities, networking events, and the list goes on. It is an understatement to say that the CERP community would not be what it is today without you. Welcome to the pod, Chris Drew.
Thank you. Really happy to be here.
Round of applause. We'll insert it in post. Welcome. Are you a listener to our Humble Planorama podcast?
I am. It's been wonderful over the years to hear from awesome planners who I know and some folks I got to know even better through the podcast. And in general, I'm a huge fan of podcasts. The time I love to listen to podcasts is actually when I'm doing the dishes at home. It's my motivation to get through them and to make sure they get done so my wife is happy. And I just find lots of different times to just decompress and think and enjoy and listen to podcasts. So I've always been a fan of the medium.
Perfect. Well, welcome. I think this is your first podcast that you've been interviewed on.
It is.
It's also my first podcast where I am the interviewer.
Okay.
So we're going to get through this together.
Absolutely.
Let's go back. We've listed your accomplishments. What makes you great? Why are you here today? How did it all begin? What got you into planning school?
Great question. There's not one particular thing. There's a number of different almost ecosystems in my childhood and my early life that I think led me to TMU, formerly Ryerson. One of them would be the influence of my parents, both of them, but my dad in particular, in the sense that he grew up in a family that was a railway working family. So his dad, my grandfather, worked for the railway. So he would always tell us stories of my grandfather working on the railway. So one of the fun things that my dad used to take my brother and I to is literally to go to a train station and watch trains from a very, very early age. And my brother and I were always just fascinated at the size, the scale, the noise. So from a very early age, we had transportation, transit, trains ingrained in us. And then, you know, my parents, including my mother, were very generous at taking my brother and I to lots of fun train and transit museums in Southern Ontario. And in one in Gatineau as well. So it was really a family experience. And then further on, I think I grew up in Brampton, very suburban, low density community at the time. Coming into Toronto, driving in on the Gardiner Expressway, and as a kid, just looking out the window and seeing all the tall buildings, all the excitement of downtown Toronto, that was an influence. Another influence, I would say, my parents' church, which I attended every Sunday. My dad actually worked there. They had a library in the church. And one of the books, a non-religious book, was The City of Brampton Official Plan. And I was, again, very thick binder. These are the days before it was online. It might have been online. I don't think it actually was, because this is the mid-90s. And I love the schedules section. This is such a geeky answer.
But this is the book at your church. They have the Brampton Official Plan.
They had the City of Brampton Official Plan in the church library. And, you know, the text was probably above my head, but the maps uh-huh. were amazing. And I was just fascinated to learn about how our city was working, how it should work, the different schedules. And then one other influence was my uncle, who actually is a planner. And in his home office library, they had the Town of Ajax official plan and lots of other planning documents. They had copies of NRU. So it was kind of a confluence of those things. I loved cycling in Brampton. And I had, my parents were very generous at giving me a lot of freedom to cycle and a lot of trust. So I did a lot of cycling. So it was really just a combination of those things. And then I think, again, we didn't have really the internet. So we got the book of different programs from many universities. So I applied to political science at the University of Ottawa. I applied to planning at the University of Waterloo, and it was then Ryerson. And I just honed in on it. It was something, for me, it was something specific. It just seemed more relevant and specific than just political science. With all due respect to people who took political science, it just seemed more practical.
They could be listening to this podcast right now.
They could be listening. And that could have, it was almost a coin flip in a way, but there was just this ongoing sense from an early childhood that planning was the right path for me, and I have no regrets. It's been an amazing career. But it was definitely those early influences from my parents, from growing up in Brampton, that I really attribute to the decision to do planning.
I'm going to really sum that up as, at church, they showed you the official plan, the planning Bible. And that showed you the way.
To the heavens of planning.
Yeah, here we are.
It
sounds like, really, in a big way, also transportation,
yes,
transit and biking, those sorts of things got you into planning, got you to go to school here at TMU. And then how was your experience at TMU? Did you have other experiences beyond transit?
Yeah, I did. The TMU experience overall was amazing. I was there for a little bit longer than your typical four-year undergrad. I was actually there for 7 years for various reasons, which we might get into.
Getting Dr. Chris Drew.
Yeah, Dr. Chris Drew. Yeah, I mean, in addition to transit and transportation, which I was really interested in, I think the community consultation, community meeting aspect, and there was a particular professor, you might have had him, Cosney,
of course,
who really encouraged students to not treat planning school as a 9-to-5 job, to get out there in the community to try different things. So that impacted me, I think, a lot in terms of community consultation, politics, those aspects of planning, in addition to my passion of transit and transportation.
Great. And we're doing the speed run through your career. So you graduate from SERP, and now you've been for many years working at, I did the name properly in the
you
intro,
did.
But what was for many years Divine Park LLP, now merged with Kagan Shastri.
Yes. Yeah, so I started in 2015. So between 2009 and 2015, when I graduated, I did a whole sort of range of things, more political staffing, community engagement, tried my hand at being a self-employed consultant, but then was determined to find my start in planning. And this opportunity came about in a very kind of unusual way, through networking. And I haven't really looked back ever since. It's been an amazing, really, experience, and it's been an amazing opportunity to meet more planners, clients, developers, city staff. I've really been able to be exposed to a very broad range of the planning ecosystem through this role.
What does the day-to-day look like for a land use planner at a law firm?
So no day is the same, because no site is the same, no client is the same. It's really a mixture, and it's almost like I'm warping from different ends of the city or the region. So it could be a combination of project management for a site plan application. It could be doing some due diligence on a site for a client where they're looking to acquire it, or, you know, kind of want to kick the tires on it, so to speak. It could be helping colleagues prepare for an Ontario Land Tribunal hearing through sending out the notice of the hearing, of the first happening of the hearing, which is the case management conference. And then it could be a sprinkling of business development and planning volunteering. So it could be I'm taking a client out for coffee to check in with them, see what they're hearing in terms of industry trends, gossip, breaking news, potential announcements from the province in terms of planning legislation. And then it could be grabbing a coffee with a student through my volunteer work through the School of Urban Regional Planning Alumni Association. So it's really a fascinating mixture. I mean, there's deadlines and dates and things that I know are coming, and then there are kind of surprises or new things I'm asked to do on a daily basis. So that's really the exciting part, that it's not boring, it's not the same, and it's very people-oriented. Mm. You're constantly dealing with people, with staff, with clients, with colleagues who are consultants. So it's, every day is unique, which I love.
Sounds like a really wide range of skills needed for the job. For a current planning student who wants to become a land use planner, or specifically a land use planner in a law firm, is there anything that they could be doing? Is there anything they should be leaning into learning at school that's going to really prepare them for that?
Absolutely. There's a lot of really simple, easy to access things that students could familiarize themselves if they want to be specifically a land use planner in a law firm, or I would say more broadly a land use planner at a planning consulting firm. So the number one recommendation I say to students is check out, for the City of Toronto, the Application Information Center.
Great idea.
And that's something that maybe isn't necessarily specifically mentioned in planning school, but there's no reason a first-year planning student shouldn't know within the first 2 months of them being in planning school at TMU that the Application Information Center exists. And it's a wonderful resource. And in particular, it's the planning rationale report that's submitted for a development application. So students can read that. It's a great inventory of all of the planning layers that exist. The analysis section, obviously justifying why the development should be approved, is fascinating. And then as a complement to that, or something associated with that, is the staff report, which is also available, very easy to find on the city's website. The other thing I tell people is check out, and it's a lot easier now, virtual consultation meetings for development applications, community consultation meetings. You can attend, there's no obligation to say anything. It's virtual, city staff present, and then the applicant presents. So that's another great resource that students can right away when they start at TMU, start checking out. And the more of those that students attend, the more familiar they'll become with policies, with zoning, with feedback from staff, and particularly the fun at community consultation meetings is the reaction by members of the public and how the applicant has to navigate that or address questions. And sometimes these community consultation meetings can be extremely emotional. There can be emotion from people that are extremely concerned, but then there can be emotion from people that actually want more housing. They could be young professionals like the student who want somewhere to live, who need somewhere to live. So you can get a wide range of feedback at these meetings. So I'll just stop there, but those are two very specific things that students can do if they're interested in working as a planning consultant, whether it's at a law firm or a planning consulting firm.
I think like two great ways to get a sense of how planning is done in practice.
Yeah.
To complement what you're learning at school about Absolutely. The theory and how to...
Very practical, very real time. Mm-hmm. And again, those planning rationale reports and staff reports are amazing at providing an inventory of all the layers to consider.
Back when it was not so much virtual consultations, but in person, I also thought there was actually value in attending those, yes, to see how the planning process works. But there's also a little bit of mingling that happens in person.
Absolutely.
And you can meet the people who are, you know, the transportation planner who's talking about the impacts on traffic,
yeah.
or the land use planning consultant, or who works at the city, these people in these positions that you could, you know, maybe bump into them as you're getting coffee and a donut before the presentation.
And you hit the nail right on the head. I always encourage students, whether it's in person or virtual, after the formal presentations are done, after the Q&A is done, approach those city staff members, approach those consultants, approach the applicant, and provide your constructive feedback or compliment them or say, you know, that was really interesting, would love to learn more. Could we grab a coffee, or when is the next meeting you're presenting at, or what are some of the other projects you're working at? It's your chance to interview them. And again, there's no reason why you can't start building those contacts in first year. And you know, over your 4 years, if you go to several of these meetings, that means that some of these people will have seen you for 4 years. And then that puts you into a good position to apply for positions, maybe use them as a reference. They might be a studio potential client. lots of ways to cultivate that relationship if you start early. So I would definitely encourage, you don't necessarily just have to show up to the meeting, but you can get to know some of the people presenting. And generally speaking, most people presenting are thrilled to help the next generation and young people.
It can be, I remember as a student, intimidating to be networking as a student, whereas I think once you're a working professional, you're going, why was I so nervous to put myself out there and talk to working professionals? What's your opening line? How does a student go out there? What should they be asking you to make the introduction?
So if it's a great question. If you're a student and you attend a community consultation meeting, let's just use that as an example, and you want to talk to the planner or talk to the applicant's team after the meeting or set up a coffee, my advice would really be to just simply tell the student to ask the person to expand on their thinking or cite other projects they're working on or talk about their career journey. Really simple, basic questions. And then I think once students
the kind of things they might ask on a podcast.
Exactly. And it's actually really simple. And part of it is you're not asking the question to get a specific answer, you're asking it to build a relationship. So, you know, sometimes when students would say to me, well, I have nothing to ask, I don't know what to say, I just say, well, it's really simple. Again, it's ask someone to expand on something that they talked about, or say, that was a really interesting point, or put yourself in the shoes of the prospective local resident or someone who might want to move into that building. So for example, if you're a cyclist and you want to talk to the applicant, you could say, well, I think it's great that you've integrated cycling so well into your development. I can see myself living in this building, and that's great that you've thought about cyclists. Or maybe there's some ground level retail, for example, and say, well, I love getting coffee with friends. That's really interesting that you've included ground level retail into your development. Are there other projects where you've done that? I mean, that's a question right there to, again, just start the conversation. But again, I tell students, don't put too much pressure on yourself. Don't worry too much about forming the perfect question or giving the impression that you have a PhD in planning or the smartest person in the room. No one really cares about that. They're just happy that you're engaging with them, and they recognize where you're at in life. So, you know, don't sweat it too much is my advice to students.
Great. Let's take you back to planning school.
Okay.
Young Chris Drew, wide-eyed, ready to take on the world. Did you do field trips?
We did do field trips. They were amazing.
Where'd you go?
In 2004, September 2004, we went to New York. Sorry, let me back up. I think it must have been September 2003, we went to Montreal. That was my first one. And then September 2004, we went to New York.
And field trip highlight?
Well, really, really hard to nail down. They were both just so immersive experiences. I'll start with Montreal. And I believe that was the first time I had been to Montreal and actually explored it kind of as a young person, adult, away from a trip with my parents. I don't think I had been there with my parents. So this was my first time as a, you know, young adult. And it was amazing. And just one quick story, and this might show how sheltered of a life I had. That was the first time I had sushi. It was amazing. It was just...
Come to planning school. The sushi's great.
Yeah, the sushi was amazing. And it was a dinner with some friends who were amazing. We're still friends to this day. They came to my wedding. And that was an amazing experience. So I think that experience stood out for me and really showed me the opportunities that food has with planning in terms of, you know, food, culture, and that is an important aspect of planning. Great retail, the ability to have restaurants, which is walkable. I mean, we were exploring Montreal without a car, which... from a kid from Brampton was still an amazing experience because, you know, Brampton unfortunately is very car dependent. So Montreal was fantastic. New York was also fantastic. And one quick story was that I was a huge fan of The Daily Show, and I was absolutely determined to be an audience member of The Daily Show. So there was a bit of free time for the New York trip. And, you know, there was different groups of friends that would kind of do different things. And I just kept setting out on my own every day when the formal part of the field trip was done, to get to the west side of New York, to get in the standby line, to get in the audience. And I think I tried 4 days successfully, and I never got in. I was always like the third in line before the cutoff, or the second in line. But I kept trying. I kept trying. And it was fun just navigating the subway system, the transit system on my own, but also just seeing that part of New York, which isn't really necessarily a tourist type area. But
where
I saw
is it?
So it's I don't even know necessarily the cross street, but it was a little bit more in Midtown, definitely on the Hudson side. There's a big aircraft carrier that's near there, that's a museum. One of the interesting components is I saw the West Side Highway, which was previously an elevated expressway that was made to be ground level. So I think it was maybe 8 lanes in total, which fast forward was one of the debates for the Gardner East situation. And in Brampton for 413 being a 400 series highway or a boulevard. So this was an example in Manhattan where they actually removed an expressway, made it ground level. And in my perspective, it worked really well. It allowed for more development, it allowed for more mixed use, it improved the pedestrian realm. You still had to cross an 8-lane road, but it was a wide pedestrian crossing, safe. So I just discovered that experience on my own. And actually in line, there was a couple of people I met and had really interesting conversations with, even waiting in line. So, you know, although I didn't get into The Daily Show as an audience member, just the trek getting there and exploring that neighborhood was an unexpected surprise. There's a rail line that's buried close to there, and a couple of places it actually pops out. This is the line that goes into Penn Central Station, and then it follows basically the Hudson River all the way up, I think probably to Albany or maybe New Hampshire. I think that, so that was fun getting there. So that's what really stood out for me.
It wasn't about getting on The Daily Show after all. It was about the journey and
the friends
you made along the way.
Friends you made, the unexpected things you noticed by just saying. And yeah, the other people that, my other classmates, did think I was a little crazy and nuts. And I did socialize and see them in a couple of evenings. But, you know, after the formal sessions ended, they just knew that I was going to take off as quickly as possible to try and get in that standby line.
If they don't want to be on The Daily Show, you're wasting your time.
There you go.
Trying to be friends with them, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. You deal with a lot of provincial policy documents.
Yes.
And municipal policy documents. Chris Drew, if you were a policy document or legislation or guideline, what would you be?
So I love this question. I'll just back up that this is the equivalent of asking my wife what font she would love to be. What Harry Potter character she would love to be. So for both of us, we can go to this level of passion and be specific. So
passion, nerdiness.
Nerdiness,
what's
enthusiasm,
the
whatever you want to call it.
Respect for a topic.
Yeah. So this answer might not surprise you, but the document would be the Metrolink's big move, the regional transportation plan.
Chris Drew, the big move.
That's what it was called when it initially came out. They dropped that as branding, but it's effectively the same thing for the more recent version. And I think there's further iterations of the document that are being worked on. It can be found on Metrolinx's website. Fun fact, some of the graphics and maps in that were made by a TMU planning alumni.
Name
so
drop.
That's really cool. Anthony Smith.
Mm-hmm. 2016 with me.
There you go. So that was really cool when he mentioned that. So it's an amazing document. I mentioned earlier when I was a kid, I was fascinated by the schedules of the official plan, which are the maps. And I love this document because of, I mean, the text is important and relevant in terms of the policies, but I love the map. And the map really shows the future potential of the region. It's a network effect. There's lots of lines on it. And if this was in place today, it would be amazing and obviously help many people's commutes. I mean, lots of people will, you know, debate over certain lines in the map, maybe certain technologies, maybe certain priorities. But holistically, from an optimist point of view, I think everyone generally loves to see that vision. It would put us on par with other places. You know, and obviously the map isn't designed to show everything. There's lots of people that would argue that in Toronto, our bus network is essential. So you can't glaze over and get distracted by the shining objects. You have to always remember what is the workhorse of the system, and it's generally the buses. So continue to invest in buses. Don't just put all your eggs in one basket and build subways everywhere or literally LRTs everywhere, as important as those technologies are. So I love that document when it came out. I love the current version of that document, future versions of that document. There's a great book called Transit Maps of the World. There's two volumes of it, and It would be great one day to see our regional map look similar to other cities around the world. And it's obviously desperately needed to have a more robust transit network and many more lines throughout the region.
Okay, let's dig in. How just on transit, it's been such a passion for you for such a long time. I want you in 30 seconds, tell me, how can transit save the world?
It can save the world by saving people time. And one of the ways it can do that is dedicated space for transit. So one example I'll just pick, in my community where I grew up, Brampton, there's a proposal for a bus rapid transit line between Brampton and Vaughan. And this is a very busy corridor. Right now, the buses are stuck in congestion. So you can have lots of vehicles with one occupant in front of a bus that could have, you know, 50, 60, 70 people, even more if it's an articulated bus. And I just think that's wholly unfair, unproductive, and all the people sitting on the bus, their time is being wasted. So transit can save the world because it can save people time. And by saving people time and giving them a better feeling, we're helping the environment, we're helping the economy, we're addressing the housing crisis. It's the multiplier effect. People's time is incredibly precious, especially if you're working class, you're shift working, you've got kids, maybe you're taking care of elderly parents, maybe you're working multiple jobs. And if your commute is unpredictable, maybe sometimes it's 20 minutes, maybe sometimes it's an hour, maybe sometimes it's 2 hours, that is really frustrating and demoralizing. And you can just see a picture of people, for example, waiting at Airport Road and Highway 7, Queen Street in Brampton. There's dozens and dozens of people at the bus stop, and they can see the bus in the distance, and it's slowly creeping to them, but it's absolutely stuck in traffic. And I've been that bus passenger. I am that bus passenger, and it just drives me absolutely nuts. And it's a mistake. It never should have happened. When they expanded those roads, they should have put or left space for bus rapid transit. They didn't. It's a lot more expensive to retrofit roads and build transit infrastructure after the development or after cities have built up. So they're now getting to it. Metrolink's in the city of Brampton, which is great. It will still need funding. This is more than 30 seconds. but transit can save the world, and one way it can do that is save people time, and that will encourage them to support more transit investment, which will help to save the world.
It's the most efficient way to benefit the greatest number of people and how they get around the city and how they go about their work.
And not only benefit the people that are using it, but also, as has been discussed or as everyone knows, benefit even the people who aren't using it. If you're a car driver and there's less volume on the road of cars because people are choosing transit, that helps you. So it helps people who need to use transit, who want to take transit, who want to get out of their cars. But even if you're never going to use transit, it still helps you.
Alrighty. Now, another deep one. Who inspires you, Chris Drew?
Well, there's a lot of people. I'll try to whittle it down. I would say, you know, my parents, I'm grateful that they took a young Chris Drew to so many train and transit museums.
To God for writing the Brampton
trains.
Official plan.
There you go. The Bible that is the Brampton official plan that was in my parents' church. My wife, we actually talk about planning a lot, and she gives excellent feedback, and obviously feedback in terms of what it's like for her to take transit or sometimes her concerns or worries, so that's a really valuable perspective. There's lots of, you know, consultants, colleagues, fellow alumni like yourself that I'm always inspired by, students.
Chris Drew.
So it's a lot of, you know, it's really a lot of people. Maybe just one, if I have to be specific, current example is I've gotten to know very recently a lot of new Canadians. And when I say new, they've been here less than a year. They're starting their planning careers. In some cases, they've found jobs quite quickly, which is great. And I've been happy to help them in that process. And so that's inspiring to leave your home country and say, I want to do something different, go to a completely new country, start fresh and navigate everything you have to navigate. I'm really inspired by that. So that's been a very recent experience I've had. I've helped a lot of students who were born here, but recently I've been connected with a lot of students or alumni or planning professionals who are starting their careers who have been in Canada for less than a year. Mm-hmm. And so that's been really inspiring to see their hard work, tenacity, interest, passion.
Yeah. Tell me about that. How important is that like the planning profession can make sure that these like new perspectives are represented in it, and that like people who are just moving to Canada can be involved, or people who maybe have been in Canada for a long time but underrepresented can be part of the planning profession?
It's really critical to help get a broader perspective to make sure people are included. It makes you as a planner better, and you can feed off their passion and their frustrations. So, for example, I was speaking to someone who's been in Canada for only 4 months, and she was talking about the challenges of Brampton Transit, living where she lives, and the need for more frequency, more faster service, and what her life is like. She's actually going to be starting in the master's program in September. But great. Hearing those stories really motivates me and should motivate the profession to keep advocating for more and not rest on our laurels. And that's someone's very first impression to Canada. There was another person I've been helping, also very relatively new to Canada, and he was talking about how much electrification is used for their transit, I think commuter rail system in India. And here in our region, we're only just finally starting to invest and get into that. So I found that inspiring in the sense that other places in the world are doing this, and we need to continue the push for electrification, particularly on our rail networks. And that means that we need to advocate for those significant investments, including to politicians, to say, yes, you must invest, you must figure it out, you must tell society that this is worth the investment, and whatever you need to do, make it happen, because other countries are doing this. And sometimes when folks come here, they're actually shocked at how far behind we are.
Mm-hmm. So important to look beyond our boundaries for best practices and how it's done elsewhere. Do you have a favorite city to visit or a place on your wish list that you'd love to get to?
I'll start with my favorite city. It's hard to pick, but I'll pick one just because it was such an impactful experience. So I got married in June 2019. Yes, I took the GO train to my wedding, and yes, I biked down the aisle.
We love to see it.
And it was a lot of fun. Highly recommend it to everyone. And so
was it a long aisle?
It was at the Guild Inn.
Uh-huh.
So I brought my bike on the GO train. One of my groomsmen helped me. And then I biked from the Guild GO train station to the Guild Inn. So if you think about it, that whole thing was an aisle in a way.
Truly iconic planner behavior.
Yeah, the aisle itself, that trek wasn't too long. There was a 90 degree turn I had to take, which I hadn't practiced, but I made it. I didn't hit any of the guests or wipe out, so that was
a good omen.
That was a good omen. But that was a fun day, and we were very blessed. It was a pre-COVID wedding because we had people from around the world there, and we have health challenges in our family, so it just meant at that time, we were living in ignorant bliss that we didn't have a pandemic. Fast forward to November of 2019, we did our honeymoon in Tokyo, in Japan. So that was the first time I had been in Tokyo, obviously major metropolis, but I was just struck by so many little things that I didn't expect. Their laneways, their small side streets are absolutely fascinating from an urban design density, mixed use perspective. It felt safe, they're extremely clean. Some of the very challenging zoning rules that we deal with and have to try to figure out how to navigate are almost non-existent. People share their space much more readily. They don't have as much space, but it's so walkable. Again, so many restaurants, mixes of uses. Their laneways, for example, don't have sidewalks. It's just everything is integrated. But there's such a culture of respect in terms of some of the car drivers. There's not a lot of road volume on some of these side streets, but just keeping an eye out for pedestrians. There were cyclists, there were people of all ages walking. So I didn't expect that kind of immersive laneway experience. And then the other thing about Japan that I just love, that I cite all the time, was we went to one of their hot springs up in the mountains, and we took an electrified commuter rail train to go there from their busiest station. So it's the equivalent in our region of going from Union Station to Blue Mountains on an electrified commuter rail train. And that's, it's a very dense city. So if people want, that's their way of relaxing. They go to these onsen type places. My wife and I went, and it was amazing. You were up in the forest, but the train was literally snaking through the mountains, again, electrified, and it was just such a great and relaxing way to go. And the equivalent for us is there is no train service. There is a local bus service I think you can do from like Barrie to Collingwood. It was great to be on the train. Way better than driving on the 400 highway. Just so much better. So that was a really unexpected, really fun experience. So those two things, if I awesome. Had to limit myself. Dream, ideal city. Would love to go back to South America. I loved being in Santiago. So there's definitely more cities in South America. Would love to go to Vietnam. Would love to go to... I've actually never been to continental Europe, so I have to do cycling things in the Netherlands and Denmark. I've got many friends that are shocked that I haven't been there yet. So COVID has delayed our travel plans, but hopefully one day I'll get there.
Awesome. So Japan for the high-speed rail. Do you see a future for high-speed rail in Canada?
So it's always going to be difficult in Canada, and I think it's difficult for very logical reasons. It doesn't mean we should give up hope, but what I would love people to do is to be a little bit more practical and get there, but take some necessary steps in advance. So, Japan has been investing and building in it since the 1950s. And for various reasons, they made that a societal push. We're in Canada still dealing with a very 1950s railway system, and we have major freight players involved, and that's important for Canada's economy. There's no political will by any political party to do massive expropriation or to really bring down the hammer and force the private railways to cooperate. There's been no proposal by any party to actually do that. So, but the good news is there are some really practical things that we can do in terms of frequency, reliability, and dedicated tracks. So the genesis of Via Rail's high frequency rail program is to give Via Rail more dedicated tracks. And there are corridors and opportunities to do that. And that could be leveraged in the future for higher speeds, higher speed rail. But the key thing is they have to secure the corridor and they have to have the ability in the future to upgrade. And this is really complex and difficult stuff. You know, some of the high speed rail zealots, I would call them, who are very passionate, make it sound like it's easy and simple. And it's absolutely not, because you might create a high-speed rail corridor and might look good on a map, there's lots of things that you need to consider, including the Indigenous component. Because the journey between Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal, there's going to be significant collaboration and input needed from the Indigenous community. And that's important from a legal perspective to reduce the risk that this could end up being litigated through the courts for a very long time. So that component is also really important. I believe some of it is unceded territory, so that's a component. So that's why, whether it's high frequency or high speed, that needs to be a really key component. And I find sometimes that folks who are very obsessed with high speed rail and say, well, other countries are doing it, it's easy for Canada, just don't acknowledge that portion. And that's a really important thing to remember. So
it sounds like this ongoing tension in urban planning between the means and the ends, and understanding this is the end point we want, but not ignoring the process that's required to get there to ensure that it's taking the communities that are involved along and involving people that need to be involved in decision making through it.
Yeah, and again, it just from a transportation perspective, if there could be more frequency, that's a benefit. If there could be more reliability, that could be a benefit. Having your own dedicated corridor can help reduce some of the travel time. And Via Rail and the federal government right now has a process to move forward on that. It's one of the most specific processes that's ever happened in Canada for something like this. There's an RFQ process that'll lead to an RFP process. There's been some seed money committed, and there'll be a collaboration with the private sector to actually deliver it, which is how other forms of transit are being built now. If you think of the Ontario Line or other major works, it's that collaboration between the public and private sector. You know, lots of people might have ideological perspectives on that relationship, but the key thing is identify the corridor, build in the frequency. There is going to be opportunities for electrification. You still have to deal with the freight railways. You can, again, build that frequency and reliability in. And then as you get more information, as you get into more detailed design, and as there's a potential for private sector players that have experience doing this in other countries, there could be a process to upgrade to high-speed rail at some point. But you have to start this process now, and that's what they're on. So I think that really between folks who really want high-speed rail and people who are just, I just want better service now, and communities along the way who still want their existing service, I think that there's a lot more that people agree on. What it will require from all political parties is political will. You can't have a situation where one government loves this, another government comes in, doesn't think it's a priority, and stops all the work. It's really hopefully going to require nonpartisan, all-party political will.
Perfect. We're talking politics. You brought us here. We are about to head into a Toronto mayoral election.
Yes.
What's your prediction?
I think housing is going to be a key topic, given who some of the leading candidates are. I think that's very exciting for planners. I think that's an important conversation. I think it'll be at the forefront in a way that I haven't seen in a mayoral election in my time since coming to TMU in 2002. So that's extremely exciting. So I would encourage planning students and planners to get involved in a mayoralty campaign. It's a great way to network. It's a great way to meet people interested in the profession or working the profession, whether it's the public or private side. So I think it's going to be a very unique and exciting opportunity, and also a very focused opportunity, because instead of just a bunch of ward races and a mayoralty race, it's just a mayoralty race. It's going to go by very quickly, but topics of housing and transit are going to be absolutely at the forefront.
How does a student get involved in that?
Well, they can just, you know, the good news is it's a lot more accessible now. So all the candidates are going to have a social media presence, particularly on Instagram. So it won't be hard for folks to plug into campaigns, to send an email, to make a call to say, sign me up, I'd love to get involved. When's the next meeting? You know, you have to just say, yeah, get me involved. Like, I want to help. And then the campaigns will say, well, where do you live in Toronto? You know, would you be interested in organizing in your neighborhood? Or, you know, maybe there's some TMU classmates that would be interested in getting involved as well. You know, there'll be a policy component, but it's a great way to explore neighborhoods through grassroots activity, whether that's door knocking, making phone calls, sending emails, just getting your community engaged. There'll be a policy opportunity as well, in terms of you can tell the campaigns, hey, here's some of the issues that I'm interested in. You know, what do you think? So, you know, it's an opportunity for students to kind of also shop around to different candidates, express their point of view. But I think the leading candidates will be having policies and platforms that will really appeal to students and their interests in this time and place we are right now. The word housing crisis is so relevant. And just those two words were just not at the forefront when I was a planning student. It was just, it's the situation has gotten so bad and is affecting so many aspects of society and life. That it's going to be a very exciting time for planners, in addition to obviously what candidates are saying about the relationship with the provincial government, because there's a significant, they're calling it the COVID hangover in terms of municipal finances as well. So that's going to be another significant issue in terms of what are candidates saying about how they're going to reframe the discussion or, you know, deal with the federal and provincial governments who do need to continue to support municipalities.
Okay, beyond students, practicing planners, how does in your opinion, a practicing planner approach politics in this way? And what are the considerations, right? If you're balancing between your day job as a planner, should urban planners be staying out of politics, or is it important that they are getting involved? And how do you do that?
I think it's really important for planners to get involved. And I think there's very easy and common sense ways to make sure that, you know, there's an ethical firewall between any specific project you're working on and any broader policy goals. It's just common sense. So if I'm getting involved in a campaign, I'm not getting involved in it because I want the candidate to, in the future, if they're elected, specifically intervene in my project or help. I'm getting involved on the macro issues of housing and transit that benefit the entire city, and you know, that's good for everyone and good for all sites, really, in terms of the housing crisis being addressed and transit being invested in. So I think there's lots of ways. I mean, you could cite specific sites as just examples if you're talking to people, but it's really broader than that. And really, the candidates are going to have very specific policy frameworks. You could make suggestions on a macro level or a general level about what should happen, but it's very easy to separate your professional work and the specific things that you're working on from general conversations, general volunteering, non-specific basis. The you know, the OPPI planner's handbook, all of the OPPI information in terms of good ethics, very common sense examples in there, lots of resources and material available. If people ever have questions, they can just talk to a fellow planner. Mm-hmm. But there's lots of examples of planners being very involved, and you can absolutely separate your professional kind of day-to-day work or specific things you're working on with your political involvement. And it really is it's a conversation, whether you're in the public or private sector, between you and your employer in terms of how public you want to be. So maybe there's no obligation for you to be on an endorsement list. There's no obligation for you to stand behind a candidate and be seen in pictures. There's lots of ways to be involved kind of behind the scenes where you don't have to have your name, face, or contact information out there. But again, that's really, you know, an opportunity for you to have a conversation with your employer to ask them what they're comfortable with as well.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, though, is we're not going to have Chris Drew throwing his hat in the ring.
No.
This cycle.
No, I am not running for mayor.
Okay, you heard it here first, podcast listeners. The rumors are not true.
I will be supporting a specific candidate. And, you know, what I've learned being a former political staffer is that there's lots of ways to make a difference without your name literally being on the ballot. And I think for people who haven't been political staffers or elected themselves, it's a huge family sacrifice to be a candidate or to be elected. And it doesn't work for all families. Total respect to families that can figure out how to do it. Great. But it's a huge family sacrifice. And for where I'm at in life, I love being a mentor. I love helping other people. I love helping campaigns where I can. But I also, I can't afford to be out of the house 7 days a week, 8 hours a day, away from family. Like, it's just not possible. But again, I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything, because there's lots of ways to give back and feel like you're helping without literally being the one elected or debating in the House of Commons or on the council floor. I love the adrenaline rush. I love that. I can see it happening maybe in the very, very far distant future. But for where I'm at right now, it really, you have to be able to make sure you can not forget your family, and you know, every family's different. So if families do it and can work it out, more power to them. Great, that's awesome. But I think you've seen with you know, Mike Layton and Joe Crussey and their decision not to run, and they cited that they have very young families, they want to be around for their kids. It's really difficult. It's a very difficult job because of the level of scrutiny, because of the hours. And it's not to suggest that other types of jobs people don't work hard. Everyone works hard. All types of jobs people work hard and grind it out. It's a very intense occupation.
Yeah. This is great. Any questions that you were expecting me to ask or that you'd want me to ask that we haven't gone to?
No, I think you covered everything. I mean, you touched earlier on my involvement in the bike tours.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Yeah.
Can we talk about those?
Sure, would love to.
You've done a whole bunch of bike tours.
Yes.
Tell me which ones you've done, what's been your highlight so far, and why?
I'm almost losing track in terms of how many I've done. I do have it documented somewhere. So it started with when COVID hit and everything moved online. And I knew in September 2020 that everything would be online. And I just felt so bad for students, because my most memorable interactions were in person. So I thought, well, I'm going to step up and I'm going to organize a bike tour. We're going to have guest speakers and we're just going to bike around downtown Toronto. It's safe. It's outside. It's fun. And I can help take students to places in Toronto maybe they haven't been. And that's exactly what happened. So one of our stops was Corktown Common Park, a wonderful park in Toronto. And lots of the students on our bike tour had never been there before. That was also an opportunity for Metrolinx to be a guest speaker, which they were, because of, I think, was it public at that point? Yeah, the Ontario line was known at that point. Obviously, Go Electrification was known at that point. And that's a great vantage point to see lots of different projects. And it's just an amazing park, and the West Donlands in that park has such a rich planning history that lots of people wouldn't know about. So that was an amazing experience. And then we had so much fun, we just kept doing them. So we're coming up in September of 2023, and it'll be the third annual. And I just tell lots of people, it's the last Saturday in September. We're going to leave at 1 p.m. from the CERP building, 105 Bond Street. everyone's welcome, but please RSVP so we know what our numbers are like. We had a very big crew last year. I think we had 30 cyclists, which is a pretty big group to be taking around downtown Toronto. We had lots of people with safety vests, and we had lots of spotters and guides to help us get to our various stops. So I love it, and there's been a few in between the September traditional ones that we've done on a ad hoc basis, and it's just a great way, and I've got very positive feedback, and so I just feed off that positive feedback and say, well, I just have to keep doing this because people really enjoy it, and it's a great way for students to meet alumni, to hear from some guest speakers. It's very organic, fun in person. It's outside the classroom, it's outside of Zoom, it's outside a formal meeting, and you just, again, you just, it's amazing to hear the feedback from students or alumni or guests who have never been to that kind of part of Toronto before. Even me, I mean, just as a really, really quick example, one of our guest speakers last year was Lanark Bennett Jr., mm-hmm. who's the executive director of the Laneway Project. So he took us to this awesome laneway just off Palmerston, kind of, let me get the neighborhood mixed up, just north of Queen. And it was a really cool laneway intersection, a four-way laneway intersection. So much potential. I don't think I had seen a specific four-way laneway intersection in Toronto before. So mm-hmm. even for me as the tour guide or organizer, I'm exploring and seeing new things in Toronto mm-hmm. and hearing from new guest speakers. So it's a lot of fun, and I will continue to do it. It's also no cost to students. We just donate to the charity. I just donate to the charity of the speakers that we have. So it's also a very easy to access event. And we have students as well that sometimes they haven't done a lot of cycling or don't have any cycling experience in Toronto. So we pick a very safe route. We try to stick to bike lanes and cycle tracks. If they don't have a bike, that's fine. Last year, Bike Share Toronto helped us by providing bikes for free, which was amazing. So we'll do that again. So yeah, it's a lot of fun, and then we have an informal social optional at the end.
Excellent. Last Saturday in September, 1 p.m., circle it on your calendars.
Yeah, 105 Bond Street, come on by.
But before the end of September, SERPA has its annual spring reception, the largest really gathering of the year that the Alumni Association
yes.
brings together alumni, students, industry professionals. Are you excited for this year's event?
Very excited. It feels like so long since we had this in person. I mean, it was 2019. And 2019 was our biggest event ever. All the proceeds go to student bursaries. So it goes to a great cause. Our proceeds from the event go to help students in planning with their planning journeys, which is amazing. We're at Little Canada, which I haven't been to yet. I'm very excited for the model trains.
I believe it.
I may forget to network. I might just be glued to the trains.
Find Chris at the model trains.
Yeah, I will try not to drool on the Little Canada models. I'm really excited. And for students and young professionals, it's a very low cost ticket event compared to other events out there. Amazing way to network. And just the other day, I was inviting a student. I was like, make yourself business cards. And the student was like, well, what do I put on? Your name, your phone number, your LinkedIn, your email, and just say you're an aspiring planner. That's it. So I'm really looking forward to it. I'm very fortunate that my firm is one of the platinum sponsors, and it's a great networking opportunity. So there's going to be industry veterans there, people rising up in their careers, students. It's a great mix of people, whether or not they went to TMU or not. It's just a great planning Toronto, or actually Ontario, industry networking event. So I encourage everyone to get a ticket and come.
And it's pretty casual, right? It's not about speeches or an MC
exactly.
or anything like that. It's mostly a mix and mingle and check out the cool models.
Yeah.
At
you get a
Canada.
Free drink ticket for alcoholic or non-alcoholic. It's great. And yeah, exactly. We actually purposely keep the speaking portion extremely short. We just thank people for being there, acknowledge the sponsors, mention where the money's going, issue prizes, that's it, because we want to maximize the amount of time for people to mix and mingle, meet new people, see old friends, catch up, introduce other people to people. So we don't want to interrupt that flow, that vibe, by having a lot of people talk at a mic, especially when there's 300 people. It's very hard to keep 300 people's attention for a very long time. So we're just short to the point and let people mix and mingle.
Exactly. Sounds good. Okay, you've heard Chris Drew on your podcast airwaves. You can meet him in person this May 26th at the SERPA Spring Reception. May 25th. Thank you, Chris Drew. Now, if people want to engage with you online, do you want to plug any social medias? Can they connect with you?
Sure. I'm really easy to find on LinkedIn. It's Chris James Drew. Easy to find on Twitter. It's Chris James Drew. I'm easy to find on Instagram. It's Chris James Drew. And feel free to reach out anytime. I love doing coffees, walks, bike tours. If there's a place that you want to go on a bike tour or a walk, I'm happy to collaborate with you. We don't have to wait until September. We can just organize something for a group of people. So I love doing walk and talks. So I'm available. So reach out.
Love it. Thank you so much, Chris James Drew.
Thank you.
This has been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Hope you enjoyed our chat as much as I did. You can get in touch with me on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram at Neil Lowen. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast and stay tuned for our next episode. Happy planning.